natural history collections or systematists can get together to make this work better, and then end on suggesting some future challenges if I get there. So first, for those of you, the basic systematic, the fruits of systematic, so to speak, I would say are the tools that we provide people, pretty much can be categorized into these five things. And I don't mean to offend any systematists who add other things to this, but I think most of us have these at our core goals in doing systematics. It's providing biological names or being able to describe the biodiversity around us. We like to be able to explain to people, or actually need to understand, the distribution of these biological forms in both space and time. So that's what I call distributional data. We typically, or we try to, and I think I'll show in a minute, that even in our basic taxonomic descriptions, we are providing at least small levels of identification tools. And that's something that is growing immensely in recent years with the internet. I'll show some examples there. We also try, or many people try, to incorporate evolutionary relationships and provide a framework for storing other biological data that we may or may not have collected ourselves. But just by inherently providing classifications and biological names, we're allowing people to link biological data and store it and transfer it and hence communicate. This is an example of Bay Area Zerene, the fertile area that we have, the six species or subspecies, so to speak, that are living in Oregon right now. I show this as a good example of how complicated some of the distributional patterns can be for some of these organisms, especially when we're dealing with insects. The insect populations very often overlap. They show sometimes various levels of introgression. And it takes a systematist or a taxonomist working on these butterflies years and literally hundreds of specimens to start piecing in these maps. And even I've cheated and kind of drawn out these maps around those points, but everybody knows that that's just guesswork. This study here, there's a lot more data that we have to fill in those points more thoroughly, but I just grabbed this one off of an older publication and went to town with it. But the type of results that a systematist would produce for conservation would allow you to assess what is the potential distribution of some of these species, or where was it in time and space. The basic pieces of if you took systematics down to the very rock core bottom of what we would provide, it would be basically a binomial name, an actual description. This is the original description of this beetle down here. And then at least one specimen. There has to be at least one specimen put in a museum someplace, hopefully more than that. In fact, one specimen is kind of scary to many systematists. But one has to be, with this three combination, with these three items, you could and provided it's published, you could have, you've succeeded in producing a systematic biodiversity datum, so to speak. But we all know, being here at the ESA, that when it comes to actually dealing with hyperdiverse taxa, such as here we have of insects or mites, and especially dealing with survey work where we're out in the field collecting in these bulk sampling methods, just the sheer ability to sort through the sample and recognize which of these forms has actually been described already, has a name, and find the correct name to it is a serious task that is really... It's very difficult to approach that to a non-specialist who's not working in the field. So that's where we start to get into providing other forms of tools to help our fellow specialists and non-specialists identify these insects and figure out what they are. I pulled this out. This is a Russian key. I don't read Russian, which highlights one of the problems with our traditional approach to identifying these insects. Keys, in the traditional sense, they sure work okay, but everyone kind of thinks that everyone knows who's ever tried to use these keys. They're not only difficult to get, many times they're published in obscure journals in foreign languages. They're associated with taxa that or regions that don't necessarily apply to the system we're looking at or trying to conserve. But they're also quickly outdated, and there's no explicit way within a key like this to even know whether or not the species you're trying to identify was even considered by the person writing the key. So. In addition, a lot of the speakers earlier to me talked about, well, that if you had that Russian key and you can give that name, you're not going to get citizen scientists or non-specialists interested in the biodiversity around them really in that way. And the way we do that is by trying to extend the ability to identify biodiversity down lower into non-specialist or non-technical means of doing that. And we do that with photographs, with field guides. And that's another tool that we're developing. I think all of these things are kind of now coming together in these sort of centralized data websites. This is the best chance that we have to get actually specialists alike. You'll hear some taxonomists say they don't trust the internet identification stuff, and then when the doors close, they've got, you know, the moth site up and they're checking their identification. And so I think that everybody is actually going to have to deal with the fact that we're moving towards this system. The last before I move on to my next section is to say that we are putting these things into classifications, and this is really important, and it's actually really important for conservation. At the very minimum, when we place a species into a genus name, into a certain genus, we're actually providing some bit of information, some predictive power. We just have too many insects out here, too many organisms that we don't know anything about, and if you're going to start to create critical, understand critical habitat, know where to go, or even possibly understand how to start to restore these taxa, we can start to use these predictive classifications to infer information when we don't have very much. And I don't care what taxa you're going to work on when it comes to insects, there's going to be huge, huge gaps in our ability to definitively know what they're eating, where they're going, what behavior. Those characters are the exact same characters that we could use phylogeny to predict. Perils of using poor systematics. Most quickly, I would say that on the most simple level, it has to do with our ability to count and estimate biodiversity. So here we have two classic, or not one classic, but one classic, one not so classic, or very recent case where species were either over or underestimated based on certain characters. And taxonomists, as we learn more and more about species, we would synonymize or unsynonymize the names associated with these taxa to get a better idea of what the true biological diversity is. So here we have the Hesperia that's been separated out into a number of species, although that's still being contested, but a number of species based on morphological and molecular data. And again, another example of a highly polymorphic species such as this Coccinellid over here. What would be the ramifications of doing that? Well, if we underestimate the number of species, it seriously limits our ability to estimate the impact of certain types of land management practices or the effects of various types of environmental change. If we overestimate, we have very serious consequences, too. I like this because I think if we're overestimating the biodiversity, we run the risk of being accused of crying wolf, quite literally. And we can't. It costs real dollars, real money to throw at trying to conserve these species. If we start naming things and describing populations and calling and bringing the Environmental the Endangered Species Act to bear on things that aren't really that important, we're going to have a problem because politicians aren't going to sit around and wait for that. This is an example. Many people know the example of the snail daughter and the dam. I use this as an example because if we had known a little bit more about the distribution of the snail daughter, we probably could have foregone a whole lot of negative press against the environmental the Endangered Species Act. So how can conservation encourage good systematics or help with the effort? I bring this up. This is an example of a. I often am giving these talks to people who are not entomologists or taxonomists, and I really have to point out the idea that biodiversity data is fundamentally different than a lot of the other data we collect in the environment. It's not like reading a thermometer or a temperature. You can record that temperature, put it in the literature, and someone can recreate that datum, and they can check it and they can verify it. When you put the data in on the study of what's living in a certain habitat or where it is, you usually provide some sort of name, either the formal name or some surrogate of that name. In order to have that be reproducible or verifiable under a scientific sense, we need to have a voucher specimen somewhere. There's no way to reconstruct or go backwards from that name without a voucher specimen. And that brings me to the idea that if taxonomic names are the trade currency of biodiversity, then the voucher specimens or the specimens we have in museums are kind of the Fort Knox that gives them value. So I compare these two sites. Here's the Smithsonian. So you can think back to my first slide where I had the Checkers Taylor plot in the drawer. I realize that sometimes seems at odds with conservation, but we really, really need to have those in museums in order to have any sort of scientific validity to these names. And conservation and every effort that needs those names wants those to be as rock solid as possible. And the solidity and the strength of those names is largely inherent on the ability for taxonomists to be able to study and figure out those species delimitations. This is an example, I bring back to that butterfly example. This point down here, this is a fritillary specimen collected in 1935 by an amateur entomologist when he was a child. It's the only known specimen we have of that species from this county, and we have no specimens from down further south in the range because nobody ever had collected in that county. We presume, based on the host of the butterfly, that it was there at one time, but this species is slowly declining, moving northward, or not so slowly, it's basically gone. And it's moving up. It's still in Washington, but no longer in Oregon. If we didn't have that single specimen, we wouldn't have any empirical testable evidence that that species had ever been in that space or that time there. So what I want to say is that responsible collecting of specimens is not a bad thing. As Scott mentioned, that there are ways and protocols that need to be taken in order to make collecting responsible. But it, in fact, it's a very necessary event and should be actually encouraged. Here's another example of a centipede recently found in New York City. These things cannot be found and described if we don't actually get them into museums. Museums like the one I work at, we're trying to create services to actually encourage people to submit specimens. We're barcoding our specimens and creating citable unique numbers so that in studies like this study done on slugs in the Willamette Valley of Oregon, the individual ecologist can put these slugs into our collection and cite them in the work. If someone should have any question about the taxonomic authority of that publication, they can contact me and I can find those specimens and they can send them off to a specialist on their own or have them independently verified. We're also trying to prioritize the high-quality digital imaging of voucher specimens that are deposited so that conservationists or ecologists or non-systematists who were submitting specimens could obtain high-quality images of their specimens for publications or for their website projects. I also would suggest that individuals begin to cite the accomplishments of systematists. Many times they'll cite the evolution or the phylogenetic paper, but it's very often left unsaid what keys or what taxonomic authorities were used to identify the specimens in their studies. We're scientists too, and even though you need to be aware that these species delimitations are real scientific hypotheses that should be cited, and the tools that the systematists are using should be cited as well. Oops. Sorry. That's my time is up, I guess. And mention in papers, if you're using specimens from museums and if, in fact, you are relying on distributional data from a monograph, to cite that in your studies. Future directions. I think this symposium is a great example of where people can move to collaborate between conservation, taxonomy, systematics, and natural history museums. As some of our other talks showed, the world is changing and becoming polluted with all sorts of things that we could have never thought of. This is light pollution that has an effect on insect distributions, global climate change, and invasive species. So we really need to continue to strengthen, I think, the relationship between natural history museums, taxonomy, and conservation. And I think this is an example of where that's happening. So thank you. Yes.
A revision, and they're at that moment sitting on the world's best data set of distribution and potentially conservation status for that taxon. There doesn't seem to be very many workers at all who take that opportunity to do a conservation assessment.
Yeah, I think, so I mean, that's an interesting thing. That'd be a neat question to have a panel discussion on, because I think depending on the taxonomist or the systematist, you'll get different answers. I think at one level, there's probably a feeling from a lot of systematists that they've reached the goals of what they wanted, which is the primary goals I mentioned are they've described biodiversity, they've learned something about the species, and they haven't really taken that information to apply into an issue of conservation or not. That's one possibility. The other is something Scott mentioned. I think that many systematists are a little hesitant to start having their taxa listed, rightfully or wrongfully. I think that many of us deal with increasingly complicated bureaucratic permitting processes in order to get the specimens into the museums that we really fundamentally need. We can't do the work on little tiny beetles with photographs. We need to have the specimens in front of us, and as it becomes increasingly more difficult, anything that you can do that would even risk having it be more complicated is something that's an impediment that we need to work through. I don't think it would be a great idea, but it'll take some heart-to-heart interaction with people so that everybody trusts or develops some trust that increasing conservation concerns for some of these insects will not simultaneously underwrite their ability to get their own research questions addressed. So, does that answer?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
As we envisioned it, we get a lot of side benefits, things that would accrue. For example, the ability to build digital libraries, to automatically log and index images to servers, and to do authentication so that I could put images together and those images would say, Mike Schaff identified this on such and such and he said it was this. This would also serve, we thought, as an educational tool by allowing us even possibly to let students sort of watch work in progress, because you could actually network and broadcast these things to whoever. You could even collaborate in real time online. So a bunch of us went back home, and this has trailed off in a number of different directions. I'm not the only one or the only lab who's worked on this. I was talking to John LaSalle and the CSIRO. They've been working on doing some streaming. There's a lot of people who have begun, and Tom's talk just a few minutes ago gets into some of this. But what we were thinking about was we wanted to build a microscope, but it wasn't really going to be like any microscope that we were used to, that we used before. It was going to have all the microscope functions that we're used to. It would be controlled remotely from a computer console. You wouldn't actually be sitting there. And that hookup could be local, from a laptop in the field or from another museum or from wherever you happen to be. And we could not only scan and examine that specimen, but at the same time take high resolution, high quality photographs. And of course, the thing that we realized right away was that this was going to have to be idiot proof, because the one thing there is no shortage of is idiots. So we put together a sort of a wish list. We wanted the computer interface to be able to manipulate the specimen from on screen and rotate that in any angle so that you could see any part of the specimen that you wanted to look at. It would have to have pretty good working distance and depth of field, very high resolution optics, and a high magnification range. Of course, when we actually started talking to engineers about this, they sort of had a few hiccups with that, because a lot of what we were talking about nobody had really started looking at. This was the first version machine we got then, about a year later, in 2004. At that time, this was our first attempt at using something like this. What we had here was a specimen chamber that we built up. You can see the rotation arm here that allowed us to spin and rotate the specimen. We had an arena camera up here because we realized very early on that you could lose track of this thing once you got very close to it, and you needed a second image to sort of tell you where in the arena you were. And we were using two sorts of modeling and flash lamps on either side for the lighting. That's a little bit more what the stage looked like. In this particular one, the stage didn't move so much, but these servo motors that you see up here were doing all the rotating of the specimen. We actually got pretty good results with that, but we moved on. We had a number of significant issues, not only with the interface, but we kept working with the optics and with the lighting in particular. This is the latest instrument that we have. Just about every single piece has been swapped out from that original instrument. We're not doing anything the same way that we did initially. In this one, this whole table moves back and forth, and the lens in the camera system up here moves up and down to focus in that way. You can see here, looking down, this is where the, at least in a pin-mounted specimen, this is the specimen chamber. That chamber, which you can see is sort of opaque around here, that's lit by a series of four lights that combine both modeling lights, like on the left, so that you can see the image lit up before you photograph it, and then a series of slave flashes that actually expose the picture. That's a little, that's just another view of that. These were some of the early photographs we got. Actually, what we found out was the photography, because, you know, 2003 for digital photography was like the Stone Age already. Things advanced so fast that getting a nice color image turned out not to be such a big deal. But I wanted to show you here, we were able to go from fairly large beetles like this down to things like mounted aphids on a slide, and even things like butterfly, and we get very nice high quality images of those things. But what I really want to spend more time on, because this has been such a learning experience, is some of the things that we've learned in the process of doing this. The first was that the simplicity and the sort of obviousness of the nature of the interface is so important. We didn't realize until we actually started working, manipulating specimens from another room, let alone from another part of the world, just how simple and intuitive the interface had to be for you not to get so confused so fast that you just gave up. Focusing was one of the major problems, and also just getting a handle on how you rotate the specimen when you're working with computer controls, because we've all learned using microscopes, it becomes second nature to us. But when you're sitting at a computer control that you haven't worked with a lot, it's far from that. What we begin using now is a sort of a virtual view, so that in the interface, you see two things. You see what you're actually looking at on the insect, but you also see a virtual bug that sits here and turns as you look at it. And that feedback is really vital in being able to keep track in your mind of where you're at in viewing the specimen, especially as you get closer. It's not so bad when you're back out, like with that butterfly. But when you're in looking at a piece of an antenna, that's when it really gets tricky. Because sometimes just finding a specimen can be a challenge. And if you're somewhere else and you know the specimen's in there, but you can't find it, well, that doesn't work too well. And that's where this arena view comes in real handy. Image quality, I said, has come a long way, but that turned out not to be the most difficult part of this. It turned out to be the optics, because one of the things we wanted right off the bat was we didn't want to be changing lenses from, you know, doing a remote imaging type of thing. We wanted a single lens. Well, if you're going to go from a couple of millimeters up to several inches with a single lens, be able to get very close and very far away, that turned out to be a fairly difficult project for the engineering people to undertake. They did a number of different things with the optics, and I have to say they've done an amazing job with that. The second most critical was lighting. Partly because, again, when you're remote, you don't have a lot, you've heard people here today talk about moving lights all over the place and putting little, you know, cans and jars on top of their specimen and whatnot. You can't do that. The lighting has to be there, it has to be uniform, you have to be able to see what you're looking at, and when you push that photo button, you want to get a good picture almost every single time. That took some work. One size does not fit all. We're able to go from things like thrombaculid mites to butterflies, but we have not been able to get clear down at this point with the optics and the instrument that we have to doing things like small mites and things like bird wings. They just won't fit in the microscope. So we can do about 1 to 2 millimeters up to 3 or 4 inches. We have the ability to do both pinned and slide mounted. And this brings up another thing which somebody else mentioned today, which is safety of the specimen. Because again, in working very early with the first model we had, we realized that if we weren't careful, it'd be very easy to smash the lens down into the specimen. So the way we've dealt with that now is we built basically a virtual bubble around the specimen. And what we do is we tell the machine where the top of the specimen is and where the bottom of the specimen is, and then the software basically circumscribes a bubble around that, and it won't let the hardware go inside the bubble. I think probably the most difficult thing beyond the optics and the lighting that I talked about so far has been the IT issues, and this really came at us from sort of out of nowhere because, honestly, we just hadn't thought about it all that much, but over the last